Welcome to Jonah Carey Podcast, friends. Thank you so much for tuning in. Today's guest, how about New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio? Yeah, that's right. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. A really interesting chat. It's funny, we were having an off-air conversation. He says, I read your piece on Rusty Staub recently. Unfortunately, Rusty passed away recently. And I just turned the recorder on and off we went to talk about Rusty Staub, the guy who is the mayor of the largest city in America. And with so many things to talk about. And that's how we got off on our venture. And it was interesting because Mayor de Blasio is a huge baseball fan, huge. A big Red Sox fan in particular. Says he's never been to Yankee Stadium, never wants to go, and tweaks people a little bit with it, which I sort of enjoy. But he's very out in the open about it. Makes no bones about the fact that despite being New York mayor, he's always been a Red Sox fan. He moved to Massachusetts. His family did 1966 and, of course, the Impossible Dream season, 1967. So anybody's going to be hooked after that. We talked about that. We talked about the fact that he fancies his administration as something of a Moneyball kind of administration, which is sort of funny when you're the mayor of a gigantic city like New York, but he gets into the idea of analytics and just theories and how to make it work when you are governing, all that good stuff. And there's also some conversation about an initiative that he has for voter rights, a huge thing for me. Whoever you want to vote for, whatever party, whatever, shouldn't you be able to vote? Shouldn't it be easy to vote? It's kind of maddening that it isn't in some places. And New York State is one of them. And so de Blasio is spearheading an initiative in New York to try to make that easier as well. So yeah, if you're into sports, this is great. If you're into politics, this is great. If you're into interesting conversation, that too. And 45 minutes plus, we got into it. It was lots of good conversation and lots of interesting thoughts from the mayor. You know, the city's not perfect. Mass transit is difficult and there's congestion everywhere and affordable housing, which the mayor is committed to, but it's never easy. And you gentrify a neighborhood and, well, that's great. Now there's coffee shops, but now people can't live there. And how do you solve these problems? It's really interesting and multifaceted. I thought that he gave some thoughtful answers. So thank you to Mayor de Blasio for coming on the show and for Mike Kaska, by the way, for setting that up as well. Let's discuss the first of this week's sponsors. That is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. One day! The right candidates are out there. ZipRecruiter is how you find them. So if you're hiring, listen, every business needs great people. A better way to find them, something better than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. How about ZipRecruiter? Right now, listeners of the Jonah Carey Podcast can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/Jonah. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Jonah. And one more time, ZipRecruiter.com/Jonah. Check out what they have to offer. ZipRecruiter, it is the smartest way to hire. Thank you to ZipRecruiter for sponsoring the podcast. Some programming notes. We've got the usual slate of content at CBSSports.com. A little companion piece with this de Blasio podcast, just kind of a rundown of what we discussed, so feel free to check that out over at the website. Also doing tons of stuff for CBS HQ, CBS Sports HQ, so just hop on CBSSports.com, and there are banners and links and stuff everywhere, and just see what we got going on. It's 24-hour, 24/7 sports, news highlights, expert commentary, all that stuff, and I'm on there all the time. Talking about baseball. So whatever's going on. I can't remember how many Shohei Ohtani hits I've done so far this season, but it's a lot because he's really good. And I'm enjoying that platform. It's really fun to do the HQ stuff. So check all of that out. Also sportsnet.ca. I've got regular content on the Blue Jays all season long. And also all season long, segue, SeatGeek. Yeah, SeatGeek. It's baseball season. Why the heck have you not bought baseball tickets on SeatGeek yet? Do you need me to come over there and show you what to do? Because it is the smartest and easiest way to get tickets to every type of live event, so you should totally get on this. You're searching for a last-minute deal, planning a night out, whatever it is, SeatGeek is the way to go. For baseball, we got hockey playoffs coming up, we got basketball playoffs coming up. I've used SeatGeek for baseball. I've used SeatGeek for hockey. I've used SeatGeek for concerts. It is fantastic. It's a color-coded map. Makes it simple. So you're going to a baseball game. Should I sit in the bleachers? Should I sit behind home plate? Upper deck? What's the best bang for my buck? SeatGeek makes it extremely easy to use. You're in and out of there in a couple minutes. You got the tickets that you want to the game that you want at the price that you want. How about this? Listeners of the Jonah Carey Podcast can get $20 off of their first SeatGeek purchase. Just download the SeatGeek app and enter the promo code Jonah today, and you'll get $20 off of that first SeatGeek purchase. Again, SeatGeek app. Enter the promo code Jonah. $20 off of your first SeatGeek purchase. Could not be easier. Make it happen with SeatGeek. Thank you to SeatGeek for sponsoring the podcast. Thank you to ZipRecruiter for sponsoring the podcast. Thank you to Mayor Bill de Blasio for sponsoring the podcast. And thank you to you, dear listeners, for enjoying the podcast. You will like this one. Candid on this podcast, Mr. Mayor, so we'll jump right in since we're talking about Rusty Staub. It's an interesting thing about our baseball heroes and all that, because sometimes they fail to live up to expectations, but I feel like Staub is one of those guys who so generous, and the way that he gave toward the city was phenomenal. I'm wondering for your thoughts. I wasn't going to ask about this, but since you brought it up, about all the contributions that he's made post 9/11 to families of fallen firefighters and police officers. It's pretty incredible that a private citizen would just take it upon himself to do all of that.
Yeah, there's a kind of super being reality to this guy when you look at it in retrospect. And I want to parallel something to answer your question. Mm-hmm. I love the way you talked about when he engaged Montreal to begin with, that he didn't just think, oh, wouldn't it be nice to learn a few catchphrases in French? He felt like an obligation to learn French and deeply connect to the community. I think in an amazing way, he understood himself almost like a public servant or, you know, almost a little bit of a priestly dynamic, if you will, that he understood he had this great gift and this great opportunity, but it came with some deeper responsibility. So my sense of him, and I didn't know him personally, well, I met him, but I didn't know him personally, but my sense is like he actually believed it was his responsibility to go find out how much good he could do with this extraordinary license or franchise he had from his sports life. And it's kind of amazing because that's available to athletes.
Yes.
Now, I would say I think more are taking up that mantle in recent years in an interesting way, different versions of it. But what's beautiful about his example was it was clearly a kind of a love of humanity. It's the same thing that motivated him to speak French. It's the same thing that motivated him to help the widows and the children of the lost, you know, those we lost on 9/11 was some deep sense of devotion to humanity.
No question about it. Since we're on the baseball front, a couple of baseball questions for you. And it's no
begin
now
with the most important thing.
Of course, we're still, listen, whatever, with, you know, running the largest city in the country and so forth. We got to get to the essentials here. It's well known by now that you're a Red Sox fan, and it's an interesting one, too. Bloomberg was a Red Sox fan, and then he said, I'm going to switch gears. You got criticism from the likes of luminaries such as Bo Dietl. My goodness, that is just hot opposition. How does one go about being an avid Red Sox fan and showing up at Citi Field but not going to Yankee Stadium and so forth? I admire the tenacity and the determination, but I imagine it's not necessarily going to be a popular stance everywhere.
Well, this is what I learned along the way. And there's a big difference between Bloomberg and I on this front.
Yes.
With real respect for him. I mean, he actually once said to me he was actually a Boston Braves fan originally before they left.
Which is
not impossible chronologically. I don't know what. I would say whatever he was, baseball was not particularly central to his life.
Yeah.
Whereas for me, it's quasi-religious. And, you know, and I remind people, you know, I came by very naturally because my family moved up to Massachusetts in 1966. And then if you know anything about the impossible dream year of 1967, if you were a sentient being, you were going to be moved by that. and then 1975, which I still would argue is the greatest World Series of all time. So I felt, you know, my feeling begins with a deep kind of fandom that I think real fans understand, which is first, if you truly love the game, and second, if you believe in your team and that's not a transferable, fungible thing.
Right.
So what I found is when I started running for mayor, it was just like, let's get this over with. I am who I am. I'm not changing. It's like not something I could change. I couldn't fake it if I wanted to. Mm-hmm. It's too deep in me. And so I just kind of came out with it. And what was amazing was people liked, this is what I got all over the city. They didn't like my choice, but they did like the honesty.
Good.
And that's what I found ever since, is that pretty much people are like, okay, at least you're not, unlike, unfortunately, some people in public life, you're not lying to us, you're certainly not doing it for political advantage. Maybe it's just the truth.
Well, and it's an interesting thing, too. There's been pieces written about your love of baseball and how it dips into your political life. And one thing that struck me as pretty interesting, read a piece that was talking about how you refer to your administration as having Moneyball tendencies. Which is interesting because, again, you're running New York City. There's nothing Moneyball about New York City, whether it's the size of the city, the actual sports teams. It is a juggernaut in many ways. What did you mean? What do you mean from the idea of having Moneyball tendencies when it comes to running the city?
I don't want to stereotype. It's a great question. I don't want to stereotype the notion of Moneyball means, like, let's do all, you know, inhuman analytics and everything goes through an algorithm. Because I think the whole concept of Moneyball has been a bit reduced, you know, beyond its fullness. But what I do feel, and this is what I found so attractive about particularly the movie, I've obviously seen the movie and the book, but that the disruptive dynamic, that's what I'm getting at. The notion that so much of government, so much of every institution is a kind of, well, this is the way we've always done things, which I hear all the time from my bureaucracies. We bring in an idea, and literally you could almost script when in the meeting people are going to say, like, oh, that's not the way we do things around here, or this is, we've always done it the other way. And there's that beautiful scene in Moneyball where Brad Pitt's character is in the room with the scouts and all and has to keep cueing Jonah Hill's character to say, because he gets on base. And it was like this beautiful, you know, sort of moment of forcing the change. We do that all the time. Of saying, you know, we have to change policies if they're not reaching people, if they're not changing people's lives, if we're not getting the impact we're trying to achieve. And it's this incessant conversation. So that's what I'm trying to get at, is that you cannot run an organization effectively if you accept the rules as they are given to you.
Well, and it's an interesting one, too, because this is the mandate, it feels like, of every politician. You get into office and it's, okay, sweeping change, here we go. Particularly if you're a Democrat, because it's supposed to be a more progressive party, as opposed to if you're a conservative, you're supposed to try to hold on to things that you've done in the past. So if you're a Democrat, you're coming into any office, it's municipal, it's you know, citywide, it is nationwide, what have you, and something happens. You quote-unquote lose your mandate. Your first year is up. You botch this thing so you can't go to another thing. When you're having the internal discussions of, and we're going to get to some of the initiatives that you've put forth, but when you're having that discussion, let's call it the word mandate for lack of a better term. How important is that? How important is it to say, okay, I have X amount of time. I better get it done now because otherwise I can't. Like, what is this weird ticking clock, nebulous thing that we as outsiders don't understand that politicians seem beholden to when it comes to wanting change but not being able to affect change?
This gets to the heart of the matter. Yeah. So I will invoke sports in my answer.
Please.
Even though baseball is the one true sport, in my view, there are others. And yeah, one of the great instructive things in life is the last 2 minutes of a football game and how much it is about how you think about time. That these are all knowable facts, and we've all witnessed brilliant time management that achieves goals, and we've also witnessed this perverse thing where coaches don't seem to understand they've got 2 minutes left, and you don't know what on earth they're doing with their time. I think there's an urgency if you're serious about this kind of work, and that's the beauty of elections and terms. Like, it's super finite. And in my case, you know, 2 terms, term limited, that's it.
Yep.
We felt coming in the door the urgency of having to make immediate change. Really, if I had to borrow from any model, that's the first 100 days of FDR, which is the all-time classic,
sure.
Which was about launching yourself into change. Showing that change was tangible and real and that it could happen in short order, and then change and achievement building the next change. That was the whole theory of the case, and I think we had some success with that. You have to sustain it because the only way you can build is with the next achievement. It's like you have to build capital. You have to build momentum, and there's always challenges. But now what I find is another version of it where I have a countdown clock, so it now resembles the football game in the sense.
Right.
I've got basically 3 years and 9 months and a massive agenda, and I'm literally visualizing the last day. And I'm saying, you know, I don't want to be the coach that screwed up the time management in my 2 minutes, right? I need to know that I am lining up as much as humanly possible to be on that last day where I want to be. And I know there will be, you know, disruptions and setbacks and crises. So I have to drive people every day to compensate for that and kind of create the sense of urgency that you would feel. You know what anything's like when you're at the end and you're rushing to get everything done. I need to almost synthesize some of that now so people understand that we can't let up.
So when you came into office, did you identify a number one? I mean, we're going to go over the initiatives. 3K is a big one. Divesting of fossil fuel companies from pension plans is a big one. Democracy NYC, I'm all for voters' rights. That's all great. Did you come in and say, this is our hammer. No matter what happens, we have to get X done?
Yes, it was pre-K. That was the first one.
Yeah.
Universal pre-K for every child. When I came in the door, 20,000 kids were getting full-day pre-K in New York City. Now, basically 70,000 kids every year are getting it for free, universal, high quality. That was the mantra that we gave ourselves only 2 years to basically create a whole new universal grade of our school system. And I'll tell you, it is very interesting how human beings and bureaucracies react when there's no debate about the vision, meaning when it's just incessantly clear, here is this incredibly punishing deadline, here is this very tall order, but there's no turning back. The notion is you have to find a way, and we put it out there publicly. And this is a thing I learned. I didn't really know enough starting out that set the high public goal to force everyone's hands, your own, your bureaucracies, like everyone. The accountability actually becomes your friend. It feels terrifying.
Yeah.
But it becomes your friend. So that's what we've tried to do over and over. And when we got the first one done, of course it opens the door for more. So, you know, I would say that was overwhelmingly number one. And then, you know, right up there after it would have been fundamentally reforming police community relations, and creating a hell of a lot more affordable housing. And we've tried to stay super focused on those paths throughout.
Well, and let's go back to the teachers thing for a second. Affordable housing, lots of follow-ups here. On the teachers thing, it's very interesting. On the pre-K thing, rather, it's very interesting because I guess I've betrayed what my next question is going to be. Around the country, this is happening. Now you're seeing teacher strikes in places like Oklahoma. Fundamentally, sure. Teachers are underpaid. You're trying to expand the scope of education, but also teachers are underpaid. So there are dual pressures working here where you want to try to get to a point where it is a desirable profession and the highest quality educators are coming in who are well-paid, well-compensated, and valued in our society in a fraction of the way that other professions are valued. How do these potentially conflicting forces reconcile? You have to fundamentally raise a lot of money to get 50,000 more kids into pre-K, and you have to raise even more money to acquire the necessary teachers to be able to make that happen, in addition to fairly compensating the teachers who are just at a generic high school in New York City who still need to be paid.
So over the years, teacher pay in New York City went up pretty consistently.
Okay.
So now I think it ranks very well in the context of the nation. So that piece of the equation has been worked on productively. And I think what's coming, the chicken's coming home to roost now. And, you know, in Oklahoma and West Virginia and Kentucky is that you cannot underpay teachers and underfund education and have a successful society.
Right.
So we here traveled some of that distance previously. On the second part of the equation, the investment and how it interrelates with the teaching profession, here's what I found, that anyone who feels their profession is invested in, we're hearing this a lot in these teacher strikes around the country. It's not people saying, I want X money or I want X benefits. That's not actually the first thing they're saying. They want their profession respected. They want their work supported. They want to succeed in their work because it's pretty sacred. And so when we did Pre-K for All, what we heard from teachers was it was seismic because they saw we were actually trying to give them a much stronger foundation to work with, because what they had gotten previously was a whole bunch of kids who lost the opportunity for intellectual growth and development in the priceless early years, are literally the best intellectual development time frame to work with, and yet our education system was totally upside down. We did not require or support early childhood education, and then we wondered later on why a lot of kids did not get the education they needed. So we said, okay, we're going to lay the foundation. First with Pre-K for All, which we achieved. Now we are well down the road to all three-year-olds. I call it 3K. All three-year-olds having universal right to early childhood education. That will be done in the next 4 years. Teachers receive that as an investment in their sacred work, in their profession. It's also, in terms of teacher retention, amazing, because why would you or anyone else stay in your job if you feel the work is important, rewarding, high impact, respected, you feel there's resources? So what I hear from teachers all the time is they know anytime we have an opportunity to invest in education, we're doing it. They see it. They know we've invested a lot in teacher training and development. It's an encouragement to stick around, because isn't that the environment everyone would want? You want to feel like you're on a winning team. You want to feel like you're on a team that's, you know, growing and moving in the right direction. So pre-K had a really interesting secondary effect of helping us to create excitement in our teaching core and encourage people to be with us for the long haul.
You cited affordable housing. I'm going to read you a paragraph from a piece. This is from brickunderground.com, and it cites a Gothamist report and so forth. This is from last year about affordable housing. The beleaguered city agency is indeed facing a major funding problem. Gothamist reports that NYCHA, which is Public Housing Agency in New York City, is operating at a $14 million deficit, while needed repairs to housing would cost as much as $17.1 billion. In other words, million was the first, billion was the second. Compounding that, the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development recently announced it intends to slash funding to NYCHA, which will add up to a loss of $27.7 million in operating funds and $7.7 million in the administration of the Section 8 Housing Voucher Program. This is all great that you want to reform public housing. Wonderful, noble goal. How do you go about this when you've got federal agencies, potentially state agencies, which are going to get to some other situations? You only have so much power. How do you fight these forces that fundamentally don't want you to reform the system?
Well, I'm going to put aside the all the other elements of affordable housing, which reach millions of people, because I think that's important to put in context. The NYCHA, our housing authority, has about 400,000 residents. It's a crucial piece of the equation. But when you add up all the other things that we do related to affordable housing, it literally reaches millions. But in this piece, since that article was written, there's been a number of new developments. But I think the way to sum it all up is the city, unlike in the past, you know, I can say there's a big difference this administration from the previous ones. We've made huge, huge investments in our housing authority. Housing authority is an independent entity, but we still have felt it was very important. Not because of any legal obligation, but because it was the right thing to do to put in vast resources, $2.1 billion in the last 4 years in terms of commitments for physical capital work, $1.6 billion for operating funds. That never happened before, so that's an important beginning to the story. The federal government actually, shockingly, in this recently achieved budget, did put in some new money for public housing. No one saw that one coming, and I'd love that to be the shape of things to come, but that was very aberrant compared to the past. That original projection you referred to did not come to pass, thank God. The state government has been squirrely, now has put forward a schema for investing. I want to see that come to fruition before I believe it, but let's hope that's a promising sign. That gives us something to work with. We are, however, dealing with a situation that, you know, became outmoded decades ago. And this is the kind of strange thing that happens in America. You know, public housing for hundreds of thousands of people built with federal support and predicated upon constant federal investment. The investment's taken away. A crisis develops. It goes on for decades, essentially below the radar. Instead of anything like a coherent national discussion about how are we going to house people who are working class and low-income people and deserve affordable housing. So now we're sort of picking up tons and tons of pieces. I do believe that we being willing to consistently invest is making a difference. I do believe we can constantly put out new iterations of a vision of how to reform the place and improve the place. I don't have any illusion that we change things overnight. I think it's a long, long haul. But some people have said to me rather romantically, oh, why don't we just tear down all these old buildings? I mean, they are old. A lot of them are half century or more old. I remind them of the real painful world we're living in, where people are struggling so deeply for affordable housing that even a 50-year-old or 60-year-old building with a lot of problems, if it's a roof over your head and if we can constantly bring it up and improve it, it is better than being forced out of your city, which would be the alternative for a lot of people. And so that's what we're trying. That's the fight we're trying to fight, how to constantly improve it, one day get the resources from other partners like the state and federal government that actually might allow us to supercharge our efforts. But not give up on public housing, because giving up on public housing is basically suggesting we're going to displace a huge number of people, and I'm certainly not going to be party to that.
Speaking of squirrely state agencies and problems decades in the making, You could probably guess where this is going. It's time to talk about the MTA. Let's talk about transit.
You showed the way right there.
We got to do it. All right. So first of all, let's classify this. If you live in Dubuque or Oslo, Norway, or wherever, what is the situation right now in the New York subway? How elemental is it to people's daily lives, and what condition is the subway currently in?
It's absolutely the core of our city's economy. I can't tell you what exact percentage of New Yorkers use the subway every day, but I can tell you 6 million rides a day almost.
Yeah.
So that is residents, that's commuters who come in and work, which is, we have I'm proud to say, the most jobs we've ever had in the history of New York City, over 4.4 million jobs in our five boroughs. So a huge number of people coming each day. Obviously, most tourism we've ever had in our history, too. So there's tons of activity surrounding the subway. It's the core of everything. It is like so much else that hasn't gotten enough investment over time. It's shocking how much it does run day to day. But what we found lately is more and more delays, more and more breakdowns. It is not Armageddon, but it's very, very tough on the daily lives of many New Yorkers. What has happened the last year that actually I think is somewhat revolutionary is, unlike the previous decades where a great charade existed that it was unclear who the hell was in charge, because our Metropolitan Transportation Authority is literally was built to obscure responsibility. I'm not making it up. I mean, it's documented.
Yeah.
It was built to achieve fare increases that no taxpayer or voter would know exactly who to blame for, which was cowardly and ridiculous. But what's happened over the last decades is the power ultimately resides in the state government and in the governor, who names the head of the MTA, who determines the budget, et cetera. That has now come out in the open, which I think is very, very healthy. Just like I always say, I control the schools in New York City, I control the police, I control the sanitation department, you go down the list. It's finally become clear to New Yorkers that the governor controls the MTA and that he has to put forward the ultimate plan with the legislature to fix it. That is actually a healthy phenomenon. That will be the gateway to bigger change. So at least a beginning occurred just in the last few weeks in the state budget, where there was some new revenue devoted to the MTA finally. And very crucially, I demanded one thing in particular, a lockbox. I said, we're not going to agree to any revenue going into the MTA that then could be siphoned off the rest of the state government, which happened in the past, or siphoned off to the suburbs. And no disrespect to the suburbs, the crisis is in the city subways and obviously buses as well. We're finally making some progress essentially on the ground rules and the parameters of how to find a long-term solution. But the bigger solution is tens of billions. I believe in a millionaire's tax. I want to put my cards on the table. I've been very vocal. I think the single most equitable, progressive way to address this in the city of such extreme income disparity that we have is to tax millionaires and billionaires so that we can have a long-term funding source for the subways, and a great innovative idea called the Fair Fare, which says that for low-income people, they will get half-price metro cards, half-price fare, which is a great opportunity creator. I think that idea is going to have more and more currency as we go forward.
Another interesting proposal, which has been put forth in various circles, is the idea of congestion pricing, that you could potentially, right, that New York is choked with traffic, everybody knows this, and there are ways around this. There are certain bridges and tunnels that have tolls on them. There are certain ones that don't at all. That can be inequitable. Lower Manhattan has tons of traffic. There are ways to do this. London, you're basically paying $15 to get into downtown London. That is a substantial amount and certainly a deterrent for some people. What are the, first of all, are you in favor of congestion pricing? And secondly, if you are, what are the challenges to making that happen in New York?
I have not been in favor because the various proposals that came out so far did not address what I think are equity issues.
Okay.
I don't think it's impossible to address those issues, but here's been the problem. Done the wrong way, it is regressive taxation. It basically says if you have resources, you'll come in and you'll congest all you want, and if you don't, you're shut out. Most of the previous proposals, including the one by Mayor Bloomberg, I thought did not respond to the problem of regressive taxation, did not respond to valid hardship concerns, did not, because it's a classic example. The place that everyone we try and get to is where most of our hospitals are, for example. And that, healthcare challenges do not discriminate according to income level. If you have a problem, you have to go to a hospital a lot, you're going to be socked with that toll. And then also that it was clear in the beginning, most of the people doing the paying would be particularly in Brooklyn and Queens, and how were they going to get something back in the equation that really responded to their transit needs. I think there's actually been some progress in the last few months. The governor came out with a commission that I thought did something very smart. They looked less at the bridges and more at the physical reality of the core of Manhattan and by getting away from the bridges, I think started to address some of the equity issues for the outer boroughs. Also, one thing that did come out of the recent work in Albany was the idea of putting a surcharge for our subways and buses on the for-hire vehicles and taxis across the board, which is a good revenue piece. And another, I thought it was done in a fair fashion and one that, you know, took into account the reality of people's economic lives. The way forward, if we're going to be any kind of discussion on congestion pricing, to me, has to address these questions of equity, hardship, avoiding regressive dynamic. And maybe that conversation will start to happen now that some other things have been resolved. I would still say the magnitude of what we need, the amount of money we need to truly create a, you know, world-class MTA for a city that's going to be 9 million people soon. I don't know how you do that without a millionaire's tax, because that's going to be one of the most central ways to put together resources. I think that needs to be kept front and center. I think some people are very scared of a millionaire's tax, but if you're actually talking about something that's going to solve a long-term problem, it's one of the most sensible options.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, because we're talking about raising tens of billions of dollars for a project that's only going to bear fruit long after you're out of office, long after the governor is out of office. There's this kind of moral hazard with any grand ambition. Kennedy, at the beginning of the 60s, says, we're going to go to the moon. Obviously, for tragic reasons, he never got to see it, but he wasn't going to anyway because he wasn't going to be in office by 1969. It's such a – how does one overcome that? Maybe this is such a just basic question, but how does one overcome that as a politician to sit there and say, you know what? My fifth predecessor is going to benefit from this thing, but screw it. I'm going to do it anyway.
It's an excellent
successor,
point.
Not predecessor. Sorry, yeah.
Right, right. It's an excellent point, and I think there's a stewardship question in that.
Yeah.
Which is you don't it's like three dimensional chess, if you will. You don't get to play this game just for today.
Right.
So the decisions I make constantly, I have to think about today. I have to think about the entire 4 years I'm going to be here and what it will mean for everything we're trying to do and for people's lives. But you have to be thinking decades ahead simultaneously. We have elements in our long-term plan, which is called One NYC, that go to 2050. For example, reducing emissions in the city 80% by 2050. That is a goal that literally, if you're not setting it, you know, 3 decades plus ahead and putting the wheels in motion now, you can't get there. Now, you could say, well, wait a minute, maybe people in 2050 won't want you to have done that. I think this is a classic dynamic where you have to use your best judgment in the moment to be a good steward of the future. And the worst thing is to do nothing. Right. I would much rather have an aggressive plan in place to try and address a concern. And then later people say, oh, wait, you know, instead of a millionaire's tax, we want to do something else rather than the absence of a plan. Because unfortunately, in New York State, and I think New York State is pretty backward governmentally and politically in many ways, default has been the winner. We've obviously failed miserably as a state in dealing with mass transit. We failed miserably in terms of dealing with, for example, voter participation in election laws. There's some of the most backward election laws in the country. I mentioned before the situation with public housing where it went unaddressed for decades, just swept under the rug. I mean, I don't think it's a singular reality in New York. I'm sure it happens elsewhere, too. But there's an old world reality to New York that we have to break through where a whole lot of things don't get dealt with. And if you keep them quiet, just the cancer grows. I want to believe in our time, one of the things that we're doing reasonably good at is surfacing these problems and putting a plan to them to force some action. I can tell you one thing. A lot of people love to rule out the millionaire's tax. They love to say that's not politically viable at all, but it forces them to have to come up with a plan. And so that's one of the things I'm excited about in a good sense is let's grapple with some of these future issues by just, you know, disrupt the equation, put a plan on the table, say, hey, people, there's an iceberg up there. We're either going to deal with it or not. Here's one way to do it. You're either for this or you're for something else, but you can't be for nothing.
There's a new way to get the latest scores, news, and highlights for baseball and all your favorite sports, CBS Sports HQ. It's a brand new 24/7 streaming channel covering the biggest games, best plays, and crucial insights from around sports. You can stream it free anytime on the CBS Sports app for Apple TV, Roku, Amazon Fire, your phone, and other connected devices. And guess what? I'll be on it very frequently. Or you can also watch it online at CBSSportsHQ.com.
You talked about voting laws and voting restrictions. I am a Canadian who's lived in the States for 20 years and is actually moving back to Canada, so that's interesting. And
we'll miss you.
I'm sorry to go. I'll write frequently. But it befuddles me and frustrates me. And I would like to say that if you were on either side of the political aisle, this should be frustrating to you. The fact that it is so darn difficult to vote in the United States, especially if you're lower income, especially if you're a senior citizen, especially if you're young. And I understand that these are pockets of Democratic voters, but it shouldn't matter. Democracy is democracy. Correct. So you put forth a plan called Democracy NYC, and there are big agenda goals here. Take big money out of politics. You talk about making it easier for New Yorkers to vote. You talk about, you know, getting rid of lobbyists and campaign finance reform and getting young people ready to vote. These are all wonderful. How do you block and tackle this? How do you nuts and bolts this? And moreover, how does the nation start to follow suit? Because honestly, of all the things going on, what is more precious and important than democracy? And we are trampling on it. You can't vote if you've ever smoked a joint, gone to jail for 10 seconds. You can't vote if you don't have the right ID. You can't vote if there, it's maddening, Mr. Mayor. Yes, please help me fix this problem. Please help me understand how we can fix this problem.
I will soothe your condition a bit here because your passion is well placed. I honestly believe if you fix democracy, you start to surface a whole host of other challenges and come up with solutions. I honestly have that faith. I think the danger is when things are quiet. The danger is when people are disengaged or discouraged. Certainly, number one, survival of the planet. I have no doubt that every tick up the scale of democracy and participation brings us closer to addressing global warming. And when people are discouraged and excluded, it makes it much easier for the status quo to continue to kill us. So I'm totally there that this is the foundation of all things. On the plus side, I really want people to dwell on Alabama for a moment, because here you had all the wrong laws, all the attempts at restriction. But when people are organized, motivated, and by the way, it matters when there's good and real candidates too, they blew by it. They just blew by the restrictions. They found a way to navigate them, even though they should not have had to. And that's a reminder that even in a degraded state, we can make progress. But on the bigger solutions, I think what we've learned about social change over, you know, generations is it comes from the bottom up, not the top down, that it is sustained by growth of, you know, a movement from place to place to place that becomes something greater than the sum of the parts, that, in fact, in recent years, we're seeing an incredible kind of spontaneous grassroots organizing. What you indicated in, you know, West Virginia and Oklahoma is a great example. The extraordinary efforts of the kids from Parkland, Florida, and now young people all over the country. This is a new iteration. It's not totally dissimilar, for example, to what young people did in the civil rights movement or the anti-Vietnam movement, but it's even more spontaneous and faster and deeper, largely due to social media. I say that to say, I think that's one of the things that'll save democracy and will lead to the changes place by place that ultimately will force the bigger equation. So in New York City, with our Democracy NYC agenda, we're going to put on the ballot this fall public financing elections. It's not good enough. We have matching funds where people contribute and you get some public money back, and that's good. But you still end up having to raise a whole lot of money and go to, unfortunately, people who have a lot of money, because that's the reality of if you're going to fund a campaign and there's only so much time and energy. That time and energy should go to talking to constituents and addressing the issues. Public financing would unleash that. And the more that model gains currency, and we literally take big money out of politics because it's just not allowed in the door, I think people are going to like that model. I think it's going to be something that actually gets a lot of bipartisan support. If it's proven in enough places, it can start to become a national model. We have that power, even in the age of Citizens United, to determine our own laws. And that's part of what I think how you fight back is you do it place by place, piece by piece. Here's another example. We're going to register all 17-year-olds while they're still in high school to get ready to vote when they're 18. We're going to do very active, energetic civics education that emphasizes their civic involvement, not just voting, but day-to-day life in their community. All of these things start to change behavior and assumption. And then our state, I told you how backward it is. We don't have early voting. We don't have vote by mail. We don't have same-day registration. We have extraordinary restrictions. Bluntly, the status quo, both Democrat and Republican, trying to keep the voting pool as small as possible, limit participation, keep the same old people in office. We want to disrupt that, and there's going to be a huge campaign this spring to change laws in Albany and make the state even resemble a bunch of red states that have more advanced and progressive election laws. And this is the kind of thing I think is going to really shake the foundation in New York State when people start to realize there's a whole bunch of states that they don't necessarily agree with the politics of, but to actually allow their people to vote more effectively than their own beloved New York State. I think that's going to shake people quite a bit.
That's all you can ask for. Whatever happens, happens. As long as they're fair elections and representative elections, it's all you can ask for.
Amen.
I want to get to a few more because I know your time is limited, and I apologize. There were cohesive themes before, not in this case. We're going to go rapid fire here. So
that is baseball. We don't do any baseball on this.
Well, we could do more, but you know what? Let's save the baseball for right at the end. So you could your guys can tell me when we're a couple minutes off. And we're going to go deep Red Sox. I want to profile the Red Sox. I do want
all
to
right.
ask you.
We'll cue you when we're a few minutes out. All right, let's go. Perfect. Lightning round.
Casca and company on it. So, you are going to meet with the president in January on infrastructure. Infrastructure, a huge deal. Obviously, we've talked about elements of it. You didn't go. there were extenuating circumstances, obviously. What do you make of somebody who makes promises about issues like infrastructure, which would seem to be bipartisan and help everybody, when they butt up against other policies or words that make it difficult? I guess that's a long way of saying, why didn't you go?
The president's incoherent. Everyone knows that. Yes. And he's also, you know, crazy like a fox, right? I mean, there's a almost brilliant use of chaos that underlies all everything he does. And I think I'll speak as a progressive. I think progressives and Democrats need to start understanding that this is systematic chaos and we need strategies to fight that back. But in the case of this very specific, a meeting of mayors, bipartisan mayors, to go to the White House, talk about infrastructure. I, in the spirit of hoping there might be some real dialogue, agreed to go. And then that same morning, they attacked a number of cities, threatened to take away their funding over immigration issues. A bunch of mayors said, this is an attack on all of us. We're not going to participate in this environment. That's how it fell apart. Turned out it was nothing more than a photo op anyway. What had been purported to be a dialogue was he came in, he spoke, and he left. And that's not going to get anyone anywhere anyway. So I'm not going to fall for the – I think we know enough about Donald Trump right now to know there's no sincere commitment to governing, and we're not falling for the game. I think the only way I want to engage him is if there's actual ground rules that force a real dialogue. But I will say at the same time, we can still work with his administration if there's people who want to do real work. But we got to remember there's some norms in government. I think that, again, that chaos is causing people to overreact and feel they have to jettison some of the things that actually work. There are some societal norms and governmental norms that actually are helpful. Like you have a meeting, everyone gets to talk, and you have to think and find some common ground. That stuff will return again post-Trump, and that stuff actually does help get things done.
Acknowledging that this is a piece from last year, but I'm going to read you a passage here, and I say this as somebody, again, moving back to Canada and currently live in Colorado, so you might even guess where this question is going too. Between 2014 and 2016, despite the mayor's pledges to reform the NYPD, reduce inequality, and end marijuana arrests for the good of the city and its marginalized communities, there were more than 60,000 arrests for low-level marijuana possession, 86% of which involved Black and Latino individuals. I acknowledge to you that this is a study that end date of December 31 of 2016. I would hope there would be better news since, and I also understand that pot is not yet legal in New York State. Having said all that, where are we with this, especially when it comes to minority communities?
Yeah, that report really did a disservice in my view because it didn't compare. It just didn't compare against a whole host of realities. First of all, the marijuana arrests have gone down substantially in this administration compared to the previous two.
Okay.
Second, we do not arrest for low-level marijuana possession alone. That is the standing procedure and approach of the NYPD. If you are on a street in New York City and you have a small amount of marijuana on you, and there's no other offense you're committing, and you don't have an outstanding warrant for another crime, you're not going to be arrested, period. So the facts are very, very clear about the decline of arrests. Here's another number that's really powerful that they conveniently left out, if I may be so bold. At 2013 versus 2017 in New York City, overall activity by the NYPD, 100,000 fewer arrests overall in 2017 than 2013 for all offenses. And crime went down steadily in that time period. And again, even in 2018, the first 3 months, we've reduced arrests while reducing crime. This is a really powerful model. So I would just ask my advocate friends to look at these bigger facts. In terms of fairness, my message is clear. We're doing implicit bias training for NYPD officers. It has to be fair across the board. Yes, police activity aligns to where community complaints come from. And that is not always a perfect demographic pattern. They have to respond to community complaints. If someone says, hey, someone's smoking marijuana in the lobby of my building, the police are obligated to address that.
Yeah.
But the message, the training, the protocol is we are going to treat everyone equally, and we do not arrest. If the only thing they've done wrong is low-level possession, we do not arrest.
Speaking of criminal justice, we've got Rikers Island. We can reform it. We can close it. There are lots of factors in play, but the bottom line is that status quo hasn't really been working for a long time. How do we address that issue?
So I have a simple phrase I use. I say the era of mass incarceration did not begin in New York City, but it will end here, and I mean it. We have a plan to close Rikers Island. We are in the process right this minute of starting to approve four jails in four boroughs that will replace the entire function of Rikers Island, that will be community-based and near the courthouses in each borough. Those have to be built. We have to continue to reduce the number of people arrested by reducing crime and by diverting people away from the criminal justice system, by reducing the burden of bail. There's a host of things we're doing. We need a lot of help from the state of New York that controls the laws around trials, which would be a lot faster, and is a huge problem. We need bail reform from New York State. We need speedy trial reform. But we believe all those pieces can come together, and the plan is to close Rikers 100%, tear down the buildings, reuse the island for some other kind of governmental or public purpose. But that's going to happen. We're 100%. It's 85 years it's been there, but we are committed that it will be closed within the next 10 years.
Wow.
And I'm sorry, we have 5 minutes left, I'm told.
Perfect. Okay, I've got like two or three more. So I want to ask you about, read a great piece, and there have been a bunch of pieces written about this, about Broadway Junction. It's an interesting neighborhood. It's a highly trafficked transit hub. There are efforts being made to revive the area around it. It brings up a larger point in New York, maybe the elemental point in New York, which we did touch on before, which is you want people to live affordably, but you want to have well-run communities with amenities and so forth. And there's always a danger of gentrification. Gentrification is a double-edged sword. It's sort of good, but it's sort of not good at all. With a community like Broadway Junction, Bed-Stuy, what have you, how do you strike that balance between the two?
A huge question. I'll try and give you the short answer, but it's worth its own program.
Okay.
And I think you're doing something really important here by recognizing if we're really going to look at the wholeness of the gentrification problem, we have to look at what was there before. And for a lot of communities, what was there before was not acceptable.
Yes.
It was a unfairly a quality of life that is not what people aspire to. Often a lack of safety, a lack of amenities, a lack of opportunity. Gentrification surely does not answer all those problems per se. It might contribute to some of the solutions, but you have to have a governmental intervention to create balance and to avoid displacement. Here's the simplest way we do it. Wherever humanly possible, we come in and we preserve a lot of the affordable housing in place, meaning we literally go family by family and provide subsidies so that families from that neighborhood can stay in the neighborhood.
Okay.
That is the surest anti-gentrification tool. We use that on a very large scale. It's literally 60% of our affordable housing plan, which will ultimately reach over 700,000 New Yorkers, is based on preserving people's apartments in place through subsidy. We also can use the land use process to create new affordable housing, to leverage the fact that the private sector wants to be involved in some new communities. But to literally, we have a law now, the strongest, I think, in the nation for any big city, that requires affordable housing creation where there's new development. It is not optional. It is a requirement. That's another way to balance the pressures of gentrification. And then, of course, everything around it. Using the development process to improve schools, to create more job opportunities, things that bring up the quality of life while reducing displacement impact. It's an imperfect equation. But the alternative, which happened in my beloved Brooklyn, was if the government didn't intervene, you got all the displacement without any of the community benefits, without the affordable housing. That's the worst of all worlds.
How do you like the 2018 Red Sox? How are we feeling?
I am pumped. I'm so glad you asked.
David Price looks good.
Huh?
David Price looks good.
I think David Price has gotten a raw deal.
Hmm.
Look, I can only imagine what it's like to go into my beloved Fenway if you didn't come up. You know, I think a real interesting study should be those who came up for the Red Sox farm system historically and how better they fared psychologically, symbolically, et cetera, than those who came in. If you came in from Tampa, of all places, I mean, it's like you got flown onto Mars and put in the starting lineup, right? So I feel for Price because I think he was put through more than he deserved. But I think he's found it now. We saw it in the playoffs. It's not even just about this year. You saw it in the playoffs last year. Like something was clicking. He's been wild now. I love what I'm seeing. And I think they were really smart also to put some limits on Chris Sale because he was blowing himself out too early in the season. And I think if he's stretched out right, that's going to be really good. And it's a really balanced team. There's a lot of youth. There's a lot of homegrown talent. There's a lot of exciting, multifaceted players. So I am encouraging overconfidence among Yankee fans. This is my new effort. I try and really just pump them up like, oh, like why? We don't even need to have the season. We'll just give you the division. You're going to win already. I want them overconfident. And I want my beloved Red Sox to sneak on up, maybe not as flashy, but a really balanced, well-rounded team. What do you think?
Goodness. Wow, the underdog Red Sox, the three-time world champion. Oh, no. I'm a Montreal Expos fan, Mr. Mayer. I'm not buying any of this stuff.
Well, I have to say on that, first of all,
yeah.
If I had the power, I would just take Tampa Bay and move them to Montreal right this minute.
I will interject for 1 second, and here's what I will say about that. I know the pain of losing a team.
Yeah.
I'm also against public funding for stadia. I don't believe it's a good idea. I think we named 40 different ventures that are better off than that. There needs to be a balance, but from a fan base perspective, I wouldn't talk to somebody from Tampa or St. Pete or Orlando and say, yeah, you don't deserve it because you didn't show up. There are myriad factors why people don't go to that stadium, including that it's poorly located. It's the same crap that we heard as Montrealers, like, oh, you're not a baseball town. I would not wish that on anybody. I'd want expansion. Give me Montreal and Mexico City, Montreal and Charlotte. All that's fine. Even if a city is having trouble sustaining something, you fix the fundamental conditions. You don't dump on the fans. I believe that very strongly. Even if it meant a team coming to Montreal, which I want very much, I would not want Tampa Bay to lose their teams.
All right, that's really noble. But one counter to that. I agree with you that and by the way, I put everything on the owners. I bet we're aligned here. I think they should pay for everything.
Of course.
And when something's wrong with the team, it's because they're not investing or they're not managing. And that stadium should have been gotten rid of a long time ago. But that being said, sometimes you got to look at if the owners aren't going to do it, and if the fans can't connect with it, it kills me that a place like Montreal that I think would love it, engage it, which is so much bigger, also makes so much more sense as a place. Something's wrong with this picture that Montreal can't get a team. So I will buy into your expansion vision. But if expansion wasn't happening, I still feel some angst. And this is a Red Sox fan bias, mm-hmm. but I think I would say Yankee fans and Met fans would feel the same way. Like, come on. You gotta support your team more than that, even with the problems. You gotta feel more for it, or you do risk that it might slip away. I think there's some balance in the equation.
Fair enough. Okay, I got one more question for you. So, I've had some political types on this podcast. I had Justin Trudeau on. I had David Seamus on, who is Obama's political director. Lots of interesting folks. Lots of bold statements and so forth. Will you announce your presidential campaign on the Jonah Kerry podcast?
If I had one, you'd be the first to know.
Sweet.
I'm Mayor of New York City, my friend. That's what I'm doing.
I appreciate your time. This was a lovely chat, and good luck with it.
Thanks, man. Pleasure.